I'm not feeling very optimistic these days.
Welcome, welcome from Alpha to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 15th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Sunday, the 30th of September, 2012, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week, we talk to Professor Yanis Varoufakis about the trouble with the euro. This show is sponsored by the new monthly subscriber, Jeffrey S. Thanking you, Jeffrey. If you too would like to join Jeffrey and help keep the show more financially stable than a malfunctioning currency area, please click on the donate buttons on the podcast website. Today's guest, Yanis Varoufakis, is a Greek political economist and professor of economic theory at the University of Athens and an expert in game theory. He is the author of The Global Minotaur, America, the True Origins of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. You can find him prolifically penning his thoughts on his blog, yanisvarifakis.eu. So let's join the conversation as we begin to discuss the quagmire that is the euro and its zone.
In countries like UK and Ireland and others, we hear certain things about the crisis in Greece, about how the Greeks are lazy or they don't work very hard. What's the true nature of the crisis?
Very simple. Between 2000 and 2008, Wall Street, the City of London and the Frankfurt banks were printing oodles, tsunamis of private money. It was through financialization, through the CDOs, through the complex derivatives that were being produced at exponential rates, and which very soon became a form of money, in the sense that they were being used as means of exchange and stores of value. The private banks, they were giving a printing press to print as much toxic private money as they wanted. That money, you know, money can't stay still. It has to channel itself to areas where it can find slightly higher returns. And those areas were the periphery of Europe. Just like in the 1990s, it was Thailand and Korea and so on. In the 2000s, it was Ireland, Spain, and so on and so forth. Now, it doesn't matter where exactly it went. In Ireland, it went into bricks and mortar. It went into the real estate sector. It went didn't go through the government. It went through the from the German banks to the Irish banks to the developers. Similarly, in Spain. In Greece, that money went again to the developers, but only it went to the developers through the state. The state borrowed the money. It wasn't the private sector that borrowed it. It was the state that borrowed it in order to build Olympic Games infrastructure and all other kinds of expensive infrastructure for Greece. The fact of the matter is that when, under the weight of its own hubris, the financial sector in Wall Street, in the City of London, in Frankfurt, the result was that all this money burnt. It just turned into ashes. All those CDOs and all those complex derivatives, all this private minted money just disappeared. So there was a massive liquidity crisis. The result was that the Irish banks and the Spanish banks collapsed. The moment that investors panicked and they saw what happened in Dubai, where the private and the public are very closely intertwined, they thought, oh my God, even the public debt is in danger. Who has a very high public debt? They looked at Greece, it had 120, 130% debt of GDP. They started withdrawing money from there. The recession had already begun, so the tax take for all those governments began to decline. Liquidity was denied them, so that began a domino effect. It didn't really matter that Greece was, had a very high public debt compared to Ireland, because it all became public debt. The Irish banks' debt became public debt. The Greek public debt remained public debt. So what we had is the natural repercussion of the collapse of a system which was predicated upon the creation of huge quantities of private money by the bankers in Wall Street, in the City of London, in Frankfurt. And then immediately after that, the official sector, as it's called, the IMF, the European Union, the European Central Bank, rushed in to ensure that those private banks who created all this mess would lose as little as possible. and they tried to shift the burden of saving them onto taxpayers. It began with Greek taxpayers, Irish taxpayers, and German taxpayers in the end for all the bailout monies that our indebted countries won't be able to repay as a result of having been squeezed into oblivion.
To get to the heart of the current economic flaws, particular to Europe at the moment, we need to talk about the monetary union of the euro. Can you describe the design flaw right at the heart of the euro?
The problem with the euro is quite similar in intriguing ways to the problems of the gold standard in the 1920s. When you bind together by means of a common currency, whether this is the euro, the Deutschmark, the dollar, as in Latin America in the 1980s and 90s, or gold, as it was in the 1920s, when you bind disparate economies together by means of a common currency, something has to give somewhere. Because let's face it, within a nation, within the United States, within Britain, you're always going to have deficit and surplus regions. So whatever we do, California is always going to be a surplus region in relation to neighboring Arizona. The north of England is always going to be a deficit region in relation to southern England. When these regions are locked in together by means of the same currency, given that one region is going to be constantly in surplus relative to another one, which is going to be constantly in deficit, something has to give. If they had different currencies, the deficit region would see its own currency devalue, and that would keep a balance. Without that devaluation process in place, you need a transfer from the surplus region to the deficit region. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to break down. There are many different ways of transferring surpluses. One is, for instance, through the social security system, for instance, unemployment benefits. So when unemployment rose in the United States in 2008, much faster in Nevada and in some states than in other states, the federal system worked, kicked in automatically because the higher unemployment benefit costs of Nevada were covered by taxes imposed in New York State, for instance. So that was a kind of a transfer of surplus. But there are other ways. In the United States in particular, you have the military-industrial complex. So when Boeing gets a contract to build a new fighter jet, the Pentagon winks and says, yes, fine, but you know what? We want one factory making the plane's wings or whatever in Tennessee, another one in Missouri, and another one in Arizona that is in the deficit states. So that the transfer takes the form not of a handout, not of transfer payments in the form of unemployment benefits, but direct investment into factories and production facilities that create jobs so that the jobs are created in deficit areas. In those factories, people find work. They have an income, so they can carry on purchasing the goods and services produced in the surplus regions or parts. Now, the Eurozone never had that. We bound together 17 disparate economies without having this surplus recycling mechanism. And when everything was going swimmingly during the profligate era of 2000-2008, when capital was oozing everywhere and money was cheap and plentiful and it was flowing from the City of London, from Wall Street, from Frankfurt banks. The bankers were dead keen to lend money to whoever would take it. During that era, that period, everything seemed to be going beautifully until there was a financial sector collapse in 2008 and liquidity was withdrawn. And then suddenly, the faulty architecture, the lack of that surplus recycling mechanism was revealed. And the reason why we're now having such a huge structural crisis in the Eurozone is because just like in 1929, when the financial sector collapsed, the gold standard's faulty architecture was revealed. Something similar is happening today.
And how does this crystallize itself in the actions of the central bank, the ECB?
Well, the central bank of Europe is a very weird beast. It was created in order to mirror the Bundesbank, the central bank of Germany. Unlike the Fed in the United States, or even the Bank of England, it has a single-track mind. Its charter specifies that the only task of the ECB is price stability. Now, this is a task that the ECB performed quite efficiently, in the sense that inflation was always subdued in the Eurozone. The problem, however, is that the ECB is the only federal institution, if you want, of the Eurozone. And it's like a giant with one leg. In order to preserve the integrity of a currency area, you need both fiscal policy, which involves taxation, it involves debt, and monetary policy. The ECB only had monetary policy which is natural because that's what the central bank does. But there was no second leg with the fiscal policy tools that would be necessary to stabilize that giant. Now, once that giant was pushed over by the 2008 debacle, it started teetering. And the ECB found itself in a situation where, yes, inflation was subdued, but the very currency that it was a steward of started disintegrating. And let me just make this very precise. But what do I mean by disintegrating currency? What I mean is this. The United States is also in a crisis, was in a crisis in the 1930s, is in a crisis since 2008. But if you have $1 in a bank in Kansas City or in Tennessee or in New York, the expected value of that $1 is exactly the same. It doesn't matter in which bank you have it, which state you have it. But if you have €1 in a bank account in Athens, that has a different expected value, much lower than it would have if you had that €1 in a German bank. And of course, there are different gradations in a French bank, in an Italian bank, in a Spanish bank. The fact that the expected values of €1 in different banks across the Eurozone is so different is a sure sign of the disintegration of the currency union. And the European Central Bank is struggling to stay on top of this situation, and while preserving price stability, to ensure that the very currency over which price stability is its remit remains intact.
So how is the national debt of each of the sovereign states beginning to function under these pressures?
Well, the problem is the whole logic of the Eurozone was effectively preparing the ground for the domino effect that we've been witnessing. Imagine how the United States would be if states had debt and the federal government had none, zero, no debt at all. The federal government had no debt. That would be music to the ears of Mr. Tim Geithner and Mr. Barack Obama. But this is precisely the logic of the Eurozone. The logic of the Eurozone is to have a common currency and to have perfectly separate debts. That is, Germany has its own debt, France has its own debt, Italy, Greece, Spain, they have their own debt. And there's no common debt. Now, the problem with this is that given that the solvency of each state differs, as in the United States, right? I mean, the Californian state is insolvent, as we know, or it's teetering on the verge of insolvency compared to New York state, which is much better off. Now, it's natural that they will not all have the same degree of solvency. Greece, of course, is the basket case of the Eurozone, and you move up and up and up, and Finland and Germany are the most solvent. When you have differential solvencies, clearly, will have differential interest rates. That is, investors will be willing to lend at different rates depending on how safe they feel their money is. So they will lend much more cheaply to Finland than they will to Portugal. That's natural. But when all these countries are caught up together, they are bound together by means of the same currency, and there is a financial sector collapse like there was in 2008, then it is quite natural that the moment investors become extremely choosy as to where they put their money, that the first place they will remove their money is the countries which they consider to be most prone to bankruptcy. Call it Greece, call it Portugal, Spain, whatever. The domino effect begins. So by having perfectly separable debts and no common debt whatsoever, there is no cushion between the dominoes to stop a process whereby the fall of one domino brings about the fall of the other dominoes. And especially since you mentioned Ireland, when you have a twin crisis, you have, just like you had in 1929, states that cannot finance themselves and banks that are insolvent. When you have national banks that are depending on the state for their survival, and those national banks have gone under, and at the same time, investors are fearing that their losses are going to infect, as it happened in Ireland, the solvency of the state, then states and banks resemble two very weak swimmers caught up in stormy seas, sinking very fast, hugging each other, and sinking very fast towards the bottom. And when that happens sequentially from one country to another, that kind of agglomeration, that kind of Eurozone construction is just a matter of time before it unravels.
Historically, central banks were formed to help sponsor the government debt, but the ECB doesn't have this capability. Should we term it a central bank at all?
It's a very strange central bank. It's not unnatural that the Central Bank of Europe is sui generis, because let's face it, the Eurozone is sui generis. We've never had anything like the Eurozone worldwide, ever. perhaps in the 19th century, the Latin Union, but that was a different kind of capitalism that we're talking about. The Eurozone is a very strange beast. We've created a federation that is not federated. We've created a very large, highly financialized economy, which is very significant worldwide in terms of its impact on the rest of the global economy. And we have given it none of the tools which are necessary to sustain the shocks of a financial crisis. And the European Central Bank was constructed not to have those tools. This was an ideological decision on the part of Germany. It was a condition that Germany imposed upon the Eurozone for Germany to accept the demise of the mark.
At the time of the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, many people warned about these flaws. I read an article by the economist Wynne Godley for the London Review of Books in 1992, and he predicted spookily nearly everything that has happened. What do you think of theories that see the euro as a neoliberal and banker's dream, whereby only bankers have the power to create money and not the central bank, and then they've become the financial planners of the states? The predictable crisis that will evolve allows them to basically take apart the European social welfare state.
I'm not sure. I think that there is no doubt that a great deal of neoliberal thinking went into the creation of the euro, and ideology for that matter. For instance, the French elites were very keen to bind their own labor market onto the Deutschmark, because they could see on the other side of the Rhine, and they were always drooling at what was happening in Germany compared to what was happening in France. Let's not forget that French trade unions have always had a great deal of success in securing high wage settlements for workers. And some of the larger trade unions in France were particularly powerful politically, like the CGT, which was communist dominated. In comparison, the trade union movement in Germany was very corporatist. They had secured seats in the boards of the largest companies, from Mercedes, Volkswagen, Siemens, and they were very Menshevik, to use a very old term. They were very happy to work closely with employers, to give up any claims for significant real wage increases, indeed to deliver real wage reductions by carrying with them the majority of workers who accepted the real wage reductions in exchange for those seats in the boards of directors, as well as a maximization of the number of jobs available. So whenever there was a crisis, the trades union movement in Germany was quite keen and eager and capable of delivering real wage reductions in exchange for jobs, effectively. French capitalists looked at that German model, and they always dreamt of transplanting it into France. And for them, adopting the Deutschmark, which is effectively what the euro was the lever by which to tie the French labor market onto a corporatist German model that would allow them to suppress wages in the same way that the German corporatist model was doing. At the same time, there were people in Germany and in France, even in Italy and Spain, that saw the creation of the euro as a great opportunity to do away with all the impediments of capital accumulation, to reverse a lot of the gains of the labor movements throughout the Eurozone. So this is the neoliberal agenda. But the reason why I initially said that I am in two minds about the thrust of the question is that I'm sure, and there is quite some evidence, and I'll tell you a story about this to back it up, that the leaders that put together Europe, and effectively we're talking about two men here, we're talking about President François Mitterrand of France and Chancellor Helmut Kohl of Germany. They were far less neoliberal than all their advisors. They were creatures of the Second World War that wanted unity and, in the end, saw in the euro an opportunity to extend European Union integration. Now, I promised you a story. In 1991-1992, Jacques Delors, who was the president of the European Commission at the time, and a very influential and significant person, came up with a green paper which was proposing that the euro contains an element of a common debt, eurobonds, effectively, which would act as a shock absorber in case of a domino effect, what I was describing before. It would provide that missing leg of the giant of the euro, and could also be used as a means for promoting growth If Eurobonds could be issued centrally by the Eurozone, then the money that would be collected through them could be utilized in order to support, through the European Investment Bank, investment projects in the form of a new deal. It was a very interesting paper that Jacques Delors authored with the help of one of my colleagues, Stuart Holland, and he presented it to François Mitterrand. And I have it on good authority that there was a meeting between Delors and Mitterrand in which Delors spoke for quite a while, something like 3/4 of an hour, explaining the thrust of his paper and why he believed that Eurobonds were important and why there should be this emphasis on growth, which is the opposite of neoliberal thrust. Mitterrand was listening quite carefully, patiently. After Delors ended his presentation, Mitterrand turned around and said to him, "You're absolutely right. The euro will need something of the sort, but we can't deliver it now. Neither Helmut nor I can do it. We don't have the political clout to do everything, to introduce the euro and the euro bonds, this common debt and the growth dimension. But I tell you what," he continued, "when in 10 or 15 years," that's what his prediction was, "there is a financial crisis, the people who are sitting in our seats will have to either adopt your proposal or the euro will start unraveling." Quite prophetic words, which also show that the people who put together the eurozone were not simple-minded neoliberal, but they were drawn into a very bare minimum kind of monetary union, which was consistent with the neoliberal designs, and which in the end, as Mitterrand prophetically said, was incapable of sustaining the trials and tribulations of capitalism, especially after 2008.
"Hello, Neil.
Who are you?"
"I am the architect. I created the Matrix. I've been waiting for you."
"Why am I here?"
"Your life is the sum of a remainder of an unbalanced equation inherent to the programming of the Matrix. You are the eventuality of an anomaly, which, despite my sincerest efforts, I have been unable to eliminate from what is otherwise a harmony of mathematical precision. While it remains a burden assiduously avoided, it is not unexpected and thus not beyond a measure of control, which has led you inexorably here. As you are undoubtedly gathering, the anomaly is systemic. Anomaly is systemic. Anomaly is systemic. Anomaly is systemic. Anomaly is systemic.
So we've seen Mario Draghi as the head of the ECB launch the LTRO and the OMT. Can you explain what each of these was supposed to do?
Well, it's very simple. Both of them tried to prevent the complete destruction of the euro. When a year ago Draghi took the job of president of the ECB, within a few days he faced a very significant prospect of the disintegration of the eurozone. Spreads, if you recall, a year ago were going through the roof, and the whole edifice was collapsing. So what he did was he printed €1 trillion and gave it to the banks. This was the LTRO.
So what did he get in exchange for these €1 trillion? What was the collateral he received?
Rubbish. He received pieces of paper that, you know, of very, very low quality and very low value. But it didn't matter. What he wanted to do was to give very cheap loans with rubbish collateral to defunct banks, hoping that those banks would pass on some of that to governments, which they did. They didn't pass all of it, but they passed some of it to governments, and that bought the Eurozone another 9 to 10 months, but only bought 9 to 10 months because, you know, this is like trying to solve a major medical condition by a few injections of cortisone, but the problem carries on underneath the skin. And then in August, we had the unprecedented admission on the part of the president of the ECB that the Eurozone is disintegrating. Of course, he used a euphemism. That's what central bankers do. The euphemism was convertibility risk, which means the risk of converting back to our initial currency, that is the risk of the Eurozone collapse. And he came up with the outright monetary transactions OMT program. It's not what Draghi wanted to do. Draghi wanted to do something more radical than that. The idea here is that the Central Bank of Europe is going to be able to intervene in the secondary market to buy second-hand bonds when the spreads of a country threaten to effectively drive it out of the Eurozone and to drive interest rates in the private sector for businesses in that country to such an extent that it can no longer compete in the single market. He would like to be able to do this without warning, just like Ben Bernanke buys whatever he wants, whenever he wants, under quantitative easing. But the Bundesbank, the Central Bank of Germany, was up in arms against any such suggestion. So the only way he could buy Mr. Rasmussen, who is on the executive board of the ECB, the only German in there that he can actually do business with, and Mr. Schäuble, the finance minister of Germany, and Mrs. Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, the only way he could win them over is by promising that he would only do that, he would only enter the secondary market, let's say, supporting Italian bonds, if Italy admits to a memorandum of understanding with the European Union, the ECB, and possibly the IMF, just like Ireland, Portugal, and Greece have, a Troika program. This is the so-called conditionality. Now, the trouble with this, the condition for carrying out this monetary transaction, as he calls it, and it is a monetary transaction, if the purpose of it is to save the Eurozone, over which he's responsible, if his monetary operations are subject to approval by Troika officials and politicians, then suddenly the European Central Bank has lost its independence. But this is a condition that was imposed upon him. And also, the only way Italy or Spain, the politicians of Italy or Spain, are going to apply for a program is if the situation in Italy and Spain is so decrepit and so beyond repair that the OMT operations won't be much help.
So let me get this straight. When the banks were in trouble, they gave $1 trillion or €1 trillion without any strings attached. But when the governments are in a bit of trouble, they give a certain amount of backing, but largely neoliberal policies are attached.
Indeed, because let's not forget that the Europe, I understand Draghi on this. The ECB charter can be summarized in one sentence. There would be no financing of member state governments. Full stop, under any circumstance, even if the people there are dying. It doesn't matter. This is in the charter of the ECB. It's not something that you and I, radical thinkers, have discovered. It's the ideology of the European Central Bank. It's the law upon which the European Central Bank operates.
So how is he doing it now?
Well, Draghi had to come up with a very complex argument, which is not a bad argument, but it's a very complex argument in order to bypass his legal impediments. The argument was that the ECB is the custodian of the euro and the guardian of price stability. Well, the moment that we, as a central bank, have lost control of monetary policy because we reduce the overnight lending rate, interest rate, centrally from 1%, 1.5% to 0.75%. So interest rates should be falling. But while they are falling in Germany, they're going up in Spain for businesses. So this is a single market, supposedly. And the result, of course, is that two comparable companies, one in Spain, one in Germany, are no longer on an even level playing field because even if they have the same degree of efficiency, the Spanish company is facing much higher interest rates when the ECB is trying to push them down. Effectively, Draghi said, this means that the monetary policy transmission tools of my central bank have broken down and I need to fix them. And if this means buying Spanish bonds in the secondary market, so be it. So this is how he's justifying doing it. He says it's not financing the government, it's carrying out monetary transactions for the purposes of monetary policy, which is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Germany is famous for its export-led economy, its mercantilist approach. What are the systemic flaws associated with this economic tactic?
It's very simple. Let's say that you and I are constantly engaging in trade, and I sell you more stuff than you sell me. I have a surplus over you. And at some point, I turn around and I blame you for having a deficit. It makes no sense. This is the Eurozone. Germany demands its right, its mercantilist right, to be in surplus vis-a-vis the rest of the Eurozone. And at the same time, complains that the rest of the Eurozone is in deficit vis-a-vis Germany. It takes the intelligence of a five-year-old to understand that this is unsustainable. It was sustainable up until 2008 for a very simple reason. The reason comes in three letters, USA. The United States of America, throughout the whole post-war era, after 1947 and up until 2008, was managing the demand, the global demand for German exports. It was creating the demand was and allowed Germany to maintain a surplus both outside the European Union, the Eurozone, and within. The United States was operating like a huge vacuum that was sucking into the United States, into America, those surplus exports. And how was it financing them? Through the massive flow of capital from the rest of the world to Wall Street, which was closing the circle. But in 2008, under the weight of the financialization debacle in Wall Street, the City of London and Frankfurt, this mechanism was down. And the United States of America could no longer recycle other people's surpluses. So suddenly Germany finds itself without that vacuum cleaner that was helping stifle its surpluses. Now we have the problem that whereas the Eurozone was always a very good source of demand for Germany, now it's also a source of liabilities that the Germans are going to have to deal with. They want to maintain their surplus position and they don't want the rest of the Eurozone to be in a deficit position. They're refusing to see what a five-year-old would see, that this is simply an unsustainable logical leap.
So what would it take for the Germans to act?
I have no clue. Had you asked me 3 years ago, I would have said that Germany would allow this crisis to continue until some major economy in Europe is affected. The Portugals and the Irelands and the Greeks could be let to fester, but the moment Italy and Spain were affected, Germany would act. I was wrong. They are steadfastly refusing to act. They are doing the usual trick of one step forward, three steps backwards. You see what happened with the June agreement at the summit in Europe. Monti, the technocratic Prime Minister of Italy, and Rajoy, the Spanish Prime Minister, extracted from Germany a major concession. If it had gone through, it would have seen a decoupling of the banking crisis in the Eurozone from the debt crisis. And now we see that Germany has spent the summer months now trying to find ways of taking it back and allowing Italy and Spain to fall back into the rut, which they are doing and they will be doing. So I very much fear that we're seeing the disintegration of the Eurozone. And if we see the disintegration of the Eurozone, we'll also see the disintegration of the European Union. With Germany effectively breaking off with a number of other countries and forming a new union east of the Rhine and north of the Alps.
Will it be a crisis in the German bond market that causes them to step out?
No, I think it's going to be the collapse of Italy and Spain. When Italy and Spain just go completely and truly under, and that will affect France, and at some point Germany is going to be faced with the prospect of either jeopardizing the solvency of the German state or getting out, at which stage I think they'll get out.
Okay, we're getting there. No more compromises. I see past your disguises, blinding through you through my control. Stealing my eternal soul, appealing through material to keep me as your slave. But I'll get out. Oh, I'll get out of all your boxes. I'll get out. Oh, you can't hold me in these chains. I'll get out. Oh, I want out of social bondage. Knowing my condition, oh, is the reason I must change. See, what you see is what you get. Nothing yet.
What effect is all of this going to have on the politics of places like Greece or Ireland or Spain? I saw a poll from Greece saying that the Golden Dawn, the far right party, have nearly 20% support in Greece at the moment.
What did 1929 teach us? Two things. First, you have a common currency without a surplus recycling mechanism. The moment that the financial sector buckles under, disintegration follows. We didn't learn that lesson. And the second lesson is that when that happens, is that the serpent's egg hatches. And the only people who benefit from this crisis are not even the capitalists in the end, not even the bankers. They are the neo-Nazis, the xenophobes, and the misanthropes. This is exactly what's happening again. You know, I mean, we were warned. History warned us. What I saw in my country, Golden Dawn, which is not a neo-Nazi, it's a Nazi party. That's not even a party. They're a gang of thugs, rise from 3,000 people to being a major party, just like in the 1920s. I recommend to our viewers to have a look at what Goebbels and Himmler and Hitler were saying in the 1920s. Take their speeches in 1922, 1923, 1929, 1930, and you will find a combination of populist rhetoric, a great deal of interesting arguments against bankers, mixed up with misanthropic, anti-Semitic, disgusting talk about the solution, the final solution. That's what you have here in Golden Dawn. A lot of the things they say when they address the failure of politicians, the crimes of the bankers, the way in which the population being squeezed, is spot on. So this is what we're having. We have a repeat of the 1930s. I very much hope that Marx was right when he said that history repeats itself as farce. It doesn't look very farcical to me. It looks pretty tragic.
So yesterday in Spain, the indignados surrounded the Spanish parliament in protest at the coming policies. This is given next to no coverage in the Irish media, where we are in essentially the exact same position. And when we have something like the indignados, which would be a positive political left reaction, it doesn't get any play.
Ireland is a conundrum. It saddens me that the Irish elites have managed to convince the majority of the population that if you just go along with the demands of the European Central Bank and Germany, if you are good model prisoners of the Troika, then you will escape. You're not going to escape. Look, if Germany were a very tough headmaster, forcing upon us mean degrading ways to do our homework, but our homework would be good for us. You know, in the end, we become educated, become better and more able citizens. Perhaps that strategy would be a good one. My concern, however, is that Germany doesn't have a clue about how to solve this crisis, and that in the end, it will up its tent and leave. And where will this leave Ireland? Back into the bosom of the sterling? On its own, having expended a great deal of social capital in order to return to a fold that no longer exists? I think the Irish people have to understand that being model prisoners in a concentration camp is not a smart policy.
There is the argument that Ireland is such a large exporting nation that they hope maybe to be able to get enough surplus to get out of this dynamic. But it seems to me entirely unlikely when you look at the global economic situation.
Indeed. Spain are pretty good at exporting too. The problems of both Ireland and Spain were never that they were not efficient at producing and selling things. It was not even that the state was profligate and heavily indebted. Both Spain and Ireland had a debt-to-GDP ratio was lower than Germany's. The problem is that we are all part of a currency union which condemns our countries to a tailspin, a freefall, once you get caught up in this crisis. And there is no degree of hard work that can get you out of this. There is no degree of export-oriented growth that is feasible.
Argentina were able to get out of their crisis when they left the peg to the dollar. If the Greeks and the Irish in this scenario find it extremely hard because we don't have our drachma or our punt still there, why can't they just default 100% on their government debt and reset government debt?
Well, to do in Argentina, we would need to do two things. First, we would need to cut our link to the euro, the peg, and at once to default. Now, we can't do the first because Argentina had the peso, which was pegged to the dollar, and all it took was a decision to cut a link between the two currencies. No longer was a peso worth $1, it was worth far less, falling every day, and that created a devaluation that allowed Argentina to absorb the shocks. Now, the problem is in Ireland and in Greece, we don't have a currency that we can unpeg from the euro. We have the euro. It's like having a foreign currency, which we can't control. To do that in Argentina, that would necessarily mean that we would have to create a currency in order to devalue it. Now, there's a physical constraint. It takes months to create a currency. It would be like, imagine if Argentina had pre-announced 8 months before it cut the peg, that it was going to cut the peg. It would have gone off a cliff and straight to its death, because that eight-month period would be a period when everybody liquidates their assets and takes the money out, unless you bring... You know, you close the borders completely and you bring the army out. Still, for 8 months, you are going to have an economy that is effectively ceased to function while waiting for the new currency to come in.
But staying within the eurozone, why can't they just default on debt and stay within the eurozone and let the problem of the banks hand them over to the ECB?
We could easily do that. But to do that, we need to have a political leadership in Dublin and in Athens that is prepared to do it.
So it is a possibility. It's a way out.
Absolutely. It would have been a splendid way of dealing with the problem. A splendid way. Because think about it. What has happened now is that our bad debts, Irish bank debts, Greek state debts, debts that our nations cannot repay because we just don't have the income to repay it from anymore, or the asset values in the case of Ireland. Those bad private loans, effectively German bank loans, both in the case of Ireland and in Greece, those are bad loans. What happened was they were transferred onto the shoulders of the German taxpayer. This is what the bailout is. The money we got was a means by which the private bank losses are transferred onto the very weary, weak shoulders of the initially Irish and Greek taxpayers. But because we cannot shoulder them, they will be then transferred onto the German taxpayers, who are very cross with the whole thing. And instead of being cross with their own bankers, because no one told the German taxpayers that this is effectively what's happening, that they're paying for their bank errors, being told that they're paying for the profligacy of the Greeks and the Irish, then they are turning against the Greeks are turning against the Germans, and we have this revival of Second World War atmosphere. Now, if instead of that, the bankers lost their shirt, and then the banks were saved by the ECB, but not the bankers, who should have known better, now the Eurozone would have been back on track in a recovery phase. But instead, we have politicians who put above all else their very cozy relationship with bankers.
So it's 2017. What's the state of Europe?
Prophecy is not my strong suit. But if we just extrapolate from today, I can't see the Eurozone continuing to exist in 2017. Unless some profound fundamental shift in Germany. We are genuinely in uncharted territory here. I very much fear that the way they're trying to solve the problem, the only way that the Eurozone can continue in 2017 is if the periphery, your country, my country, Portugal, Italy, Spain, have become wastelands that resemble Kosovo. Let me remind you that the territory of Kosovo is a de facto member of the Euro. If you go to Kosovo, which is a strange place, you'll find that the ATMs and banks churn out euros. Everybody uses euros. It's not a member of the Eurozone, but it is a lawless place, a place with extremely low morale, no growth, nothing significant happening. Most of the people are trying to get out and to migrate. It's a wasteland, but it's a part of the Eurozone, effectively. Now, I can easily imagine Greece becoming something like that. Possibly Ireland, with a few pockets of industrial activity, the export-oriented part of the economy. Portugal will definitely be like that. But this whole environment of wasted lands is going to bring down Europe and eventually give rise to an implosion that will be terrible for our political economy, our social economy, and our impact on the rest of the world.
Well, on that positive note, I'd like to thank you very much, Yiannis, for the interview today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
People get ready. There's a train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All we need is faith to hear the diesels humming. No tickets, we'll just thank the Lord. Thank the Lord.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters by Sun Ra, the architect scene from the film Matrix Reloaded, accompanied by the theme tune for the English TV soap Coronation Street. You also heard Lauryn Hill with I Get Out. And to sing us out, we have Aretha Franklin with People Get Ready. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.
against the kingdom's throne.